Shall we begin? Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhi Tamastuma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Let's recite some of the verses that we're going to be studying tonight. We may try to go through a rather large section here tonight because it comes together very nicely. We'll see how we can do. We'll start with the 25th sutra. Satu karma jnana, satu karma jnana, yoge bhyopyadikatara, yoge bhyopyadikaratara, phalarupatvat, phalarupatvat, ishvarasyapi, abhimanadveshatvat, dainyapriyatvatcha, tasyaha jnanameva, tasyaha. Adhanamityeke Anyonyashrayatvam Ityanye Swayamphalarupateti Brahmakumaraha Rajagriha Bhojanadishu Tathaiva Drishtatvat Natena Raja Paritoshaha Kshuchantirva Tasmat Saiva Grahya Mumukshu bihi. Very good. So we continue our study of Bhakti Sutra, but you've already figured out long ago this is a Vedanta class. Not only is it a Vedanta class, but you've probably seen it's 100% consistent with what Narada is teaching in these Bhakti Sutras because, as we said, correctly understanding this tradition, bhakti, as described by Narada, he describes we're going to see in the following parts of the text, sadhana as a spiritual practice. But so far, we're going to see bhakti as a sadhana, bhakti as a spiritual practice. But so far, almost all of what we've been studying so far is bhakti as the goal. We called it parabhakti. We said that parabhakti, this is the goal. We need to get our feet back on the ground before we get back into the series of verses. Parabhakti, bhakti as a goal, we said, the highest form of bhakti, if you think of bhakti as love, the highest form of love, the maximum form of intimacy. How intimate can one get? If you can love someone from a distance, as they say, you can love someone who's in your home, you can love someone who's in your arms. You say we're getting closer. Someone who's at a distance, someone who's in your home, someone who's in your arms. But the parabhakti is love for one whose intimacy is infinite, which means someone from whom there's no separation at all. Aparabhakti means some separation. When you pray, hey Bhagavan, you start off with separation. I'm the bhakta and he's Bhagavan, so we start off with separation. But the parabhakti that we've been discussing in almost every class since we started this text is the bhakti as a goal, a condition in which there's utterly no separation between devotee and God. And we said that this is where bhakti and jnanam, the kind of wisdom taught by Advaita Vedanta, they come together at this point. They culminate in the same recognition of that divinity who is present in this form. Divinity which is present in your form, divinity which is present in and through every being. Okay, with that in mind, so keep in mind this definition then of parabhakti. So we're talking about parabhakti not as a practice. Several classes ago we said you cannot practice parabhakti. Why not? It's like practicing being enlightened. What will you do? You can't practice being enlightened. It's a state of achievement. It's what you reach. In the same way, you cannot practice parabhakti. Why? It's the culmination of your practice. It's what's achieved through aparabhakti, which we'll be talking about later in this text. All right, with that introduction, we'll pick up the thread with the 25th sutra, where we began our discussion today. And this actually begins a subsection of the Bhakti Sutra. There are 84 sutras. They come in five sections. And this is the beginning of the second section. But it looks to me like the division here between the first section and second section is pretty arbitrary. I don't know why the division is even there. Where there is a major division, however, is between the second part, which we're just starting, and the remaining part of the text. So right now, this division is a little arbitrary, but when we come to the end of this section, the second section, you'll find quite a significant transition as we go to the latter part of the text. We'll talk about that when we get there, of course. Okay, 25th sutra. Satu karma jnana, satu karma jnana, yoge bhyo pyadikatara, yoge bhyo pyadikaratara. Sa-tu, sa, that. And what are we referring to? That para-bhakti, that ultimate form of bhakti, para-bhakti. That bhakti, too, on the other hand, that bhakti is what? Adhikatara. Look at the end of the line. Adhikatara. It is best. It is the most excellent. It excels all. Sātu, api, also, that also, adhikatara. It is the most excellent, it excels. It's better than, especially that tara affix, usually means better than something. Better than what? Well, he enumerates. He says it's better than karma, better than jnana, better than yoga. That bhya affix means, is the ablative case, better than them. So bhakti is better than karma, karma yoga. Bhakti is better than jnana, jnana yoga. Bhakti is better than yoga, here probably referring to dhyana meditation. So bhakti is better. Then I'm just going to put these terms up on the board since we're going to be talking about them quite extensively. So this is saying that bhakti is better than karma yoga, jnana, loosely jnana yoga, and the third, which he just calls yoga, we'll treat that as dhyana, dhyana yoga, meditation. All right. Bhakti is better than karma, yoga, jnana, and dhyana. And setting this up, because we're going to talk about this quite extensively. Karma yoga is using our actions, as a spiritual path. Jnana yoga is using our intellect for the sake of spiritual growth. Dhyana is using meditation for the sake of spiritual growth. All right. Enough said. Now, this sutra says, according to Narada, bhakti is better than karma yoga, better than jnana, better than meditation. This sounds like he's ready for an argument. You know, this is one of the things that spiritual seekers love to argue about. You may not get into these arguments, but I know as a young student, he got into these arguments frequently about the efficacy of particular spiritual paths. Some people will argue for how karma yoga, since we're already engaged in so many activities, and since we're already extrovert, that karma yoga is the most effective path of spiritual growth. Others will argue that jnana yoga, since the goal is to discover that inner divinity, that discovery is definitely going to take your intellect. It requires atma vichara, it requires self-inquiry. Therefore, jnana yoga is the most effective way to reach it. Others will argue that in order to make that discovery, you need your mind to be focused, to be one-pointed, to have this ekagrata, one-pointedness of mind. How will you achieve that without dhyana, without meditation? So you can put 3-4 people in a room. Suppose we put put these three people in a room. We put the karma yogi and the jnana yogi and the dhyana yogi in the room. You know they're going to get into a big argument, inevitably. Then suppose we put one more in, the bhakta. We put them. You know, the bhakta is just going to be one more person arguing. And they're all going to have compelling arguments. The argument for each, the argument for bhakti, for jnana, for karma, for dhyana, each of these arguments are valid and compelling. That is to say, they are all important elements of a life of spiritual growth. Then why is it that Narada seems to play favorites here? Because he says bhakti is better than the other three. Well, wait a minute. Remember when we gave the introduction for this subject, we said we are talking about parabhakti. We're not talking about bhakti as a sadhana. We're talking about bhakti as the sadhya. Remember those terms? Sadhana is the means to the end. Sadhya is the goal. Parabhakti, bhakti as the goal, bhakti as enlightenment, liberation. That's how we've understood it in our prior classes. Now it makes a little sense. In fact, just to bring it in, look at the very next sutra and repeat. Palarupatvat, palarupatvat. He says it's because that this bhakti is palarupa, it's in the form of the fruits. It is the in the form of the fruits means what? It's a goal. So tell me, when you practice karma yoga, what is the goal? If you go to your job for the sake of a paycheck, you're not a karma yogi by definition. If you go to your work not for the sake of the paycheck, but as a form of spiritual growth, you are a karma yogi. But then, going to work as a form of spiritual growth, as a sadhana, what is the goal? If the goal is not the paycheck, the word spiritual growth is a little nebulous, intentionally vague. So what is the goal of that sadhana called karma yoga? Well, enlightenment. How did we define enlightenment? Discovery of the divinity which you already are. Well, it's not the same as parabhakti. Bhakti as a goal, bhakti as a phala. So could we say that parabhakti is the phala, the fruit of karma yoga? Similarly for jnana, a path of self-inquiry. jnana would best be translated like that. Jnana doesn't just mean knowledge or practice. You can't practice knowledge. If you call jnana yoga the practice of knowledge or wisdom, that's meaningless. So it would be more meaningful to say it's the practice of self-inquiry, an inquiry into the reality of who you are, and a reality of who is God, reality of the universe, that kind of inquiry. An inquiry undertaken by means of the intellect. And what is the goal of that inquiry? It's the same as the goal of karma yoga. And similarly, in meditation, what is it that you're hoping to accomplish? To focus your mind and to use that focused mind for the sake of making that recognition of the divinity within, the goal being to discover that divinity within. Well, hey, the goal of all three of these are the same. And now, if you introduce bhakti as a sadhana, it becomes a force. Notice, not para bhakti, but bhakti as a sadhana, as a spiritual practice. It becomes the fourth. All four of these are meant for the sake of enlightenment, liberation, moksha, or discovering that divinity which is present here now. That discovery indeed is parabhakti. Why? It's the most intimate condition possible. Now, one other factor to recognize before we go on to the next sutra. Bear in mind that in spiritual life, this needs to be said. In spiritual life, the goal we seek is not an ordinary goal. I bet we've discussed this before, but it's better to put it in once again. The goal we seek is not an ordinary goal. The goal we seek is an extraordinary goal. In a prior class, we probably discussed how for an ordinary goal, you're going to require an ordinary effort. For an extraordinary goal, you're going to require an extraordinary effort. So a small goal, small effort. Medium goal, medium effort. Big goal, big effort. How big would you describe this goal? Infinite. Talking about discovering God. You have to call it an infinite goal. How much effort is it going to take to reach an infinite goal? Infinite. Well, then how much karma yoga should you practice? How much jnana should you practice? How much self-inquiry should you be engaged in? How much meditation should you practice? How many times should you go to the temple and pray? You get the message. Effort alone doesn't bring the goal into your grasp. Now, those words are chosen very carefully. Listen again. Effort alone can never bring something in your grasp if it's infinite. Effort alone can only bring the finite in your grasp. So then, what we're grasping for is the infinite. My gosh, how can we ever get there? How can we ever achieve that infinite goal? How can we ever reach that infinite goal? And the answer is, it's a trick question, of course. The answer is, you don't need to reach it. You don't need to achieve it. You don't need to get it. You don't need to become it. You already are that. This is the central teaching of the ancient rishis. When they said tat tvamasi, you are that. You already are that which you want to become. You already possess that which you want to gain. That's exactly what that phrase means. Tat tvamasi, you already are that. We've commented here many times before that it's in the present tense, not in the future tense. They didn't say you will become that. They said you already are that. Which means the God of the universe that we hope to reach through our spiritual practice is already here now. So what exactly is it that we're doing then? And what it is, as we are, and this is so Vedantic, but not just Vedantic. In fact, in the next sutra, you'll see it's also, it crosses over into bhakti, but we'll just introduce next sutra. All we need to do is remove an obstacle, a barrier. What we seek is already here now. What is it that separates you from your goal? Well, in Advaita Vedanta, they'll say, ajnanam, avidya, ignorance. And in many schools of bhakti, instead of saying what separates you from your goal is ignorance, they'll say what separates you from your goal is ego, ahankara, abhimana, and that's what we'll see in the next sutra. Ishvarasyapi, Ishvarasyapi, abhimana-dveshatvat, abhimana-dveshatvat, dainya-priyatvatcha, dainya-priyatvatcha. Good. Nice sutra. He says, Ishvarasya, for Ishvara, for God. This is a fun sutra because it has two wildly divergent meanings. And both of them are accurate. This is fun. You'll enjoy this. Two very different meanings of this sutra. Both of the interpretations are equally important. Watch this. Ishvarasya, for God, or simply we say that God, Bhagavan, has. What does he have? Abhimana dvesha twat. He has abhimana dvesha because he has abhimana dvesha. Because he has a dvesha, a dislike of abhimana, ego. We'll translate abhimana as ego. Ego and pride here. So, abhimana dvesha, dislike of ego. Ishvara, the God, God has, God, or to paraphrase it, Bhagavan dislikes our egos. Not only does he dislike our ego, but Dainya Priyatvacha, he happens to be Priya, fond of Dainya, meekness and humility. Now, this is interesting. What in the world are we talking about? How do you make this transition from talking about para bhakti to now talking about Bhagavan who dislikes our egos and happens to prefer that we should have meekness and humility? You have to think a little further about these terms. What is it that keeps... What is it that keeps lovers apart? Now, here we're going to... Two levels. We're going to take it first in the traditional bhakti level. That's what we'll do right now. And then in a few minutes, we'll take it in a more Vedantic way. So right now is a very, very bhakti way of interpreting this. Two lovers have a quarrel. They're separate. What is it that keeps these two lovers separate? Pride. Ego. It's only when they get rid of this pride and ego and instead become a little soft and meek that these lovers can come together. The lover spats happen all the time. So it's that ego and pride that drives them apart. And it's the softness and meekness and humility that allows them to come back together again. Well, that's exactly what this verse is saying. This verse is saying that within our prayer life, if we look upon... Here, we're going to back off a little bit to the sadhana bhakti. If you look at bhakti as a spiritual practice, not the para bhakti, but now bhakti as a spiritual practice, at that level, obviously, your pride and ego is going to interfere with a relationship with God as much as it would interfere with a relationship with a person, with a lover. And similarly, the meekness and humility that allows you to come close to a human being, that meekness and humility emotionally allows us to come closer to God. But you can take this at a more fundamental way, and that is the God of the cosmos that we seek is already here now. What is it that keeps me from recognizing it? It's me, I, that ego, that ahankara. Now we're taking ego not in a sense of pride. Now we're taking ego in a more fundamental sense. As long as I take myself to be an individual being, an individual person with will, with an agenda, with his own life, don't I create this division again between me and Bhagavan, between Bhakta and Bhagavan? Ego is the core of our individual personalities. It's the core of our individuality. As long as you are an individual, you're going to necessarily be separate from Bhagavan. We said that para bhakti is being non-separate from Bhagavan. In order to be non-separate from Bhagavan, you have to get rid of your individuality. Hear that again, a very fundamental teaching. How can you be non-separate from Bhagavan as long as you have a sense of individuality? Only when that sense of individuality goes can you be utterly non-separate from Bhagavan. That is parabhakti. What will it take to give up the individuality? That's ego. That's why he says, Ishwarasya, now we'll get a slightly different spin on this, Ishwarasya, instead of saying for Bhagavan, in fact, how can you say for, most translations of this sutra will say, it says for God, because for God, for Bhagavan, there is a dislike of ego and a like for meekness. It's a very literal translation. You mean God has likes and dislikes? That's what it says. It says dvesha twat, because Bhagavan has a dislike for abhimana, pride, and because Bhagavan has priya, a love or preference, for dainya, meekness, humility. Oh, God has likes and dislikes, just like you and me. You like some palak paneer. Bhagavan likes dainya. this is silliness. In fact, some of you remember in 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Samopi sarva bhuteshu name dveshosti na priyaha. In 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says, samaha. He says, I am sama, samoham. I am the same. Sarva bhuteshu, towards all creatures. Towards all beings, I am the same. Name dveshyaha, for me. Na dveshyaha, no one is disliked, or nothing is disliked. Na priyaha, and nothing is liked. We're talking about the God of the universe. The God of the universe can't have likes and dislikes like you and me. So we better try a second interpretation of this verse, or of this sutra. How will we do that? Ishwarasya, for reaching the God of the universe, for reaching Ishwara, What is the problem in reaching Ishvara? The problem is abhimana ego. Therefore, abhimana dveshatva means having dvesha for abhimana, getting rid of abhimana, getting rid of ego. Literally means hating the ego, but not too hard to get another meaning. It's getting rid of the ego, Ishwarasya, for the sake of reaching Ishvara, and Dhainya Priyatva, it's cultivating. Now, you can translate Dhainya as humility. Literally, it means dinata, lowness, is a very literal meaning. It's low, being low, the state of being low, is dānya. Well, how about being utterly low because you have no ego? Ego puffs you up and dānya brings you down. So how about being utterly low? Every time I talk about ego like this, I can't help but hear my guru's ridiculous expression for ego. Yeah. Do you remember the four B's? Some of you remember? He got onto this, and he kept talking again and again of the ego, describing it with these four words: big, bloated bladder of bluffs. He would go on and on and on, talking about the ego as a big, bloated bladder of bluffs, puffed up. Well, when that bladder is no longer bloated, when it is totally deflated, not partially deflated, totally deflated, that's absence of ego. So dānyatva can mean the absence of ego. Īśvarasya, for the sake of reaching the God of the cosmos, for the sake of achieving utter non-separation from the God of the universe, what's required is abhimana dvesha. Get rid of the ego. And dānyatva, dānyapriya, cultivate dropping that ego. It ends up being the same as our teachings of Advaita Vedanta. A little different terminology. In Advaita Vedanta, we would say that the obstacle is ignorance. And the reason that Advaita Vedanta says the obstacle is ignorance, why does this ego hang on? If the ego is, and this is a big Vedantic discussion, we're not going to get far into it tonight, but if the ego is the obstacle, why does that ego persist? If the ego is simply a mental event, and we've described it in these classes as a mental event masquerading as a conscious being, your ego is a thought. In your head are many thoughts, but there's one thought that's totally bizarre. It's one thought that says, I'm not a thought. I'm a conscious being. This is ego. In a Vedantic sense, this is exactly what we mean by ego. Ego not in a sense of pride, but the fundamental sense of being an individual being, ahankara in the very literal meaning of it, aham karoti iti ahankara, that which creates aham, that which gives rise to the sense of being an individual being is ahankara. This is the one. So this we can describe accurately as a thought that says, I'm not a thought, I'm a conscious being. It is a thought masquerading as a conscious being. Well, what will it take to get rid of that masquerade? Knowledge. It's a masquerade. You have to unmask the thought. To unmask the thought is to remove ignorance. Anyway, this is a big Vedantic discussion. It's really not our topic for tonight. Just to make a brief connection for you. So, Īśvarasya, why is it? Now we have to see these three sutras together. So, two sutras back, Narada says that bhakti is best. It says better than karma, better than jnana, better than dhyana. Why does he say it best? Because palarupatvat, because the parabhakti we're talking about is the goal. Tell me, if you could have the goal or the means to the end, which would you have? I mean, you know, put it like this. If you could have an airline ticket or be in the place where you want to arrive, which would you prefer? The airline ticket is a means to the end. You actually want to, suppose you're going to India. Would you rather be in India or have an airline ticket? You get the point. The goal is obviously more valuable than the means. So in that sense, parabhakti, being the goal, palarupatvat, since bhakti is a goal, therefore it is better, it's more valuable. And the second reason he gives this sutra, Ishvarasya, this sutra is the second reason why is para bhakti best. Because para bhakti is best because all you need to discover this utter non-separation from Ishvara. Remember, you can't achieve it. It's an infinite goal, cannot be achieved through effort. Therefore, how will you reach that condition of utter non-separation? Only through a process of removal. Removing that which separates you from Bhagavan, and, as we said, removal of ego, basically. Yeah, Kabir Das had that nice doha. I don't remember the Hindi, but some of you will know it. He says that the rasta, rah, the path of bhakti, he says, is very narrow. It's so narrow, two people can't fit on that path. If you are on that path, there's no room for Bhagavan. If you're not on the path, then there's room for Bhagavan. It's too narrow. The two of you can't pass. So only when you are absent is that Bhagavan there. Or to put it in, I think this expression might even be used in Christianity. Certainly is true to the Hindu spirit, and that is, less of me means more of him. That's almost obvious. Less of me means more of him, then just extend it a little bit. So less of me is more of him is sadhana bhakti. What is para bhakti? None of me means only him, right? Less of me, more of him. None of me, only him. That's the goal of para bhakti. All right, let's continue. Tasyah jnanameva, tasyah jnanameva, sadhanamityeke, sadhanamityeke. Tasyah, for that, and it's in the feminine gender, so it means for that para bhakti, for reaching, for attaining that para bhakti, for reaching the goal. Jnanameva sadhanam, knowledge alone, or self-inquiry alone, is the sadhanam, the means, iti, aka, iti, thus, aka, according to some. According to some people, knowledge alone is the goal. I'm sorry, knowledge alone is the sadhana, is the means for reaching the goal. The goal, if you call it parabhakti, the goal, if you call it utter non-separation from the God of the universe, the goal, if you call it discovering the divinity within, whatever you call the goal, it's the same goal. He says that the sadhanam, iti aka, according to some people, jnanam eva sadhanam, the only means, eva, only, jnanam eva, knowledge alone, self-inquiry alone, is the means for reaching that goal. Who would say such a thing? An Advaita Vedantin. That's what Sri Shankaracharya said, jnanameva moksha. Moksha, liberation, is jnanameva, is through knowledge alone. Why would he say it? What is it that prevents you from recognizing the divinity that you already are? The problem is ignorance. If the problem is ignorance, if the problem is the failure to recognize the divinity you already are. We'll turn this into a bad joke. If the problem is the failure to recognize the divinity that you already are, what is the solution? The solution, some people will say, is shirasasana. Do some yogic headstand, do some pranayama. Wait a minute. If the problem is non-recognition of an already existent divinity that you are, how is this yogic headstand going to help you? My guru, Pujaswami Dayananda, had a nice warning here. He said, do you know what? That's the last thing you should do. Why, you ask? Well, if you do the shirasana, the yogic headstand, it makes all the blood go to your head. In fact, they say that it's good because you get more blood in your head. It makes your brain work more and think more. But then Pujya Swamiji observes, if your head is full of ignorance and you think more, you're only going to get more confused. So, that's a bad joke. But the point is well taken, and that is, if the problem is failure to recognize the already existent fact of your divinity, if the problem is self non-recognition, the solution can only be knowledge. That's why Sri Shankara said, jnanam eva moksha. That's why iti ak, according to some people, jnanam eva sadhanam. Knowledge alone is the means. But, as you know, not everyone agrees with that. Other people have other opinions, and that's what we see in the 29th sutra. Anyonyashrayatvam, anyonyashrayatvam, ityanye, ityan, iti, anye, iti, thus, anye, according to others, which means not those Vedantins, according to some others, what is the sadhana, what is the means for getting this parabhakti? The means is anyonya ashraya. Anyonya is mutual. Ashraya here means dependence. Anyonyashraya is a common logical term. It's used in tarka, in the field of logic and reasoning. It's used to describe mutual dependence. Anyonyashraya is mutual dependence. So, iti ak, iti anye, according to others, what is the means for gaining this parabhakti? He says the means is anyonyashraya. He literally is saying the means is mutual dependence, but the implication, of course, is that which of these do you need? The prior sutra said jnanam eva. Now the second sutra says anyonyashraya, which means you need all of them. All right. So some people will say you need jnana. Other people will say you need jnana, you need karma, you need dhyana, and you need bhakti as sadhana, not bhakti as a goal. Which is right? Oh, here we go. Back in that room with the argument, which do you need? Which sadhana is best? Which one is the one? Everyone wants to know which one is best. And who said you get to choose? Why should one be best and the others be inferior? We've had this discussion, I think, in other classes, but it's maybe the time to bring it up here. None of these are optional. None. We need each of them. The traditional metaphor that we've used here before, it's like cooking rice. What do you need to cook rice? What cooks rice, of course, is fire. I'm going to put this up on the board so you can see the metaphor real clearly. What cooks rice is fire. What is it that makes you discover the inner divinity? You have to discover. Discovery means remove the ignorance. Discovery means jnanam. So, what cooks rice is fire. What makes you discover Bhagavan's presence here now is jnanam. All right. You've heard this from me before, I think. If you have a 1 kilo of basmati rice and a roaring fire, can you cook it? Huh? Not exactly. Not without a pot. And so if you have a pot and the rice and a fire, can you cook it? Not exactly, not without water. Now, very interesting. Does the pot cook the rice? No. Fire cooks. Does water cook the rice? No. Fire cooks. Heat cooks. Can you cook the rice without the pot? No. Can you cook the rice without the water? No. Which of these is unimportant? All right. They're all required. And this, honestly, is exactly what Vedanta teaches. In Vedanta, even in Shankaracharya's Advaita Vedanta, jnana is called the mukhya sadhana, and karma, dhyana, bhakti, etc. are called avantara sadhana, secondary. Mukhya means primarily, primary. I don't need to write all this stuff up. Mukhya means primary. Fire is primary for the sake of cooking the rice. The pot and water are equally important, but they're secondary in the sense that they're not doing the actual cooking, but they're necessary. So therefore, they're called avantara, or secondary. Mukhya sadhana, avantara sadhana. Primary means, and the secondary means. Now, with that in mind, if you're going to cook rice and I give you, and I say, well, okay, you can cook, but you have a choice of three. Would you like to have a pot? Or instead of a pot, would you like some water? Or instead of a pot or water, would you prefer to have fire? Which of these three would you like for the sake of cooking the rice? You get the point. We need all three. And this, indeed, is a proper way of understanding all of these sadhanas. And why stop at three? There are many. So we need all of these sadhanas, or as we've joked here before, we need all the help we can get. That's pretty clear. We need all the help we can get. Now, we can say that jnanam, the prior sutra, jnanam eva sadhanam, somebody will say that knowledge alone is the means. This is a person who's focused on jnanam as the mukhya sadhana, as a primary means. Doesn't mean it's the only thing required, because then in the next sutra, it says, anyonyashrayatvam iti anye. Others recognize the mutual dependence of all of these factors. And certainly there's mutual dependence of the pot, of the water, of fire. They're mutually dependent. So this is what's being said. Now, that being said, what is Narada's interpretation? So the previous two verses gave two other people. So iti, ak, some. Some people say jnanam eva sadhanam. Some people say knowledge alone is the means. Iti anye, but then others still say anyonyashrayatvam. Others say that there's a mutual dependence, that you need all three of these. Well, what does Narada say in the 30th sutra? He says, Swayam phala rupateti Brahma kumara, the son of who? Brahmaji had many sons, manasaputras, one of whom was Narada, the author of this text. So Narada here refers to himself in the third person. He did that once before. So here he is referring to himself as the son of Brahmaji. So iti Brahma Kumaraha. Thus, according to Narada, according to Brahma Kumara, thus Narada, the son of Brahma, he says, Swayam Palarupata. We just saw this. We saw in the 25th sutra, Palarupatvat, he's saying virtually the same thing here. He says, Swayam, itself. Itself is Palarupata. Itself is in the form of the goal. So once again, Narada is, it's actually very clever, sidestepping that argument. Remember in that room, are these guys arguing? One guy arguing karma yoga is best, another bhakti is best, another dhyana is best, another jnana is best. They're arguing and arguing. Narada won't enter that room and argue. He says, what's best is stop arguing. What's best is the goal. The goal is para bhakti. The goal here is reaching Bhagavan. The goal here is recognizing your non-separateness from God. So he says, that is the best. That is the goal. Does it mean the others are useless? Sadhana. You know, the traditional metaphor, before we move on, the traditional metaphor is all of our avantara sadhanas, all of our secondary means, in fact, all of the sadhanas, just all sadhana is like a boat used to cross a river. The point is, once you've used the boat to cross the river, the boat is of no special value to you, having reached the far shore. Its value is only in ferrying you across the river. But tell me, when you get to the other side of the river, you want to carry this heavy boat on your back as you continue your journey? Certainly not. You want to leave it behind. So sadhana, properly understood, is like that boat. That is, its value is only sadhana kale while you're engaged in spiritual practice. But as we've said several times, the goal is more valuable than the means. Being in India is more desirable than the ticket. That's what Narada is saying here. But don't make the mistake of saying, oh, all I need is parabhakti. Why do I need to bother with this jnana, karma, and dhyana? Why should I bother? All I want is parabhakti. Give me parabhakti. Fine. Can you get to India without that ticket? Can you get across that river without the boat? You get the point. Very obvious. We need the means, but let us not confuse the means and the end. And that's what's been taught here. All right? And just to finish off this section, he illustrates with an interesting drishtanta. Drishtanta means metaphor. In the 31st and 32nd sutra, he gives a very interesting metaphor. Rajagriha bhojanadishu, tathaiva drishtatvat. It's a little obscure. In fact, it's quite obscure. Raja means king. Rajagriha, the king's house. Griha means house. King doesn't live in a house. He lives in a palace. Raja Griha means palace. Raja Griha, king's house, a palace. Bhojana, eating. Adishu, with regard to these and similar things, tata eva, in the same way, drishtatvat, because of the nature of it being seen, tata eva. This is very... We said long ago that sutras are written in this very terse style. It really doesn't lend itself to literal translation. If I were to try to literally translate the sutra, for example, it wouldn't make much sense. It would sound like this. Drishtatvat, because of the nature of being seen, tata eva, in that way alone, Rajagriha bhojanadishu, just as in the situation of the palace and eating and other things. Huh? All right. Drishtatvat, because this is seen. What is seen? Something is seen in the case of a palace and in the case of eating. So he's introducing, in this sutra, he introduces two metaphors, two drishtantas. The metaphor of the palace, Rajagriha, and the metaphor of eating, Bhojana. Now, what is the metaphor? You have to look at the next sutra. So he's introducing the metaphor, drishtanta, in this, but the actual drishtanta is given in the next sutra. Natena raja paritoshaha, natena raja paritoshaha, kshutchantirva, kshutchantirva. Tena raja na paritoshaha, tena, by that. And this is where it's obscure. You have to, by that, by what? You have to make the right connection here. The only connection that makes sense, you know, there are many possible interpretations here, but the only interpretation that seems to make sense, tena jnanena, by that knowledge. Two sutras back, jnanam eva sadhanam. So what he's doing now is refuting those other two. Remember, the first guy said, jnana is all you need. The second guy said, oh, you need the combination of them. Then Narada says, you don't need any of them, you need parabhakti. And now he is supporting his point of view by refuting the others. And he's going to focus on jnana. Tena jnanena. By that knowledge, tena, by knowledge, raja na paritoshaha. This is obscure, we have to explain. The king will not be pleased by knowledge. Huh? That's what it says. The king will not, by knowledge alone, tena, the king will not be pleased. How about this? We should translate this. Of course, we don't have kings in this country. We've got all of our politicians. President would be more than a king. So we need king would be something. How about mayor? The king is a king of a kingdom, right? So what are our kingdoms, our cities, and the head of the city is a mayor. Suppose you're having a problem. Some problem with the taxes on you. We'll just turn this into a story. Your house is reassessed. You've gone through this already, right? Every several years they come around, do this reassessment so that they can charge you more taxes. New Jerseyans are already the most heavily taxed people in this country, and which means they have to just keep working at it even harder so that we can maintain our status as being the most heavily taxed state in this country. So, you get your new tax bill. It's almost doubled. You're outraged. How could you do that? You call the assessor's office and they say, we're sorry, this is our new policy. These are new numbers. This is it. You can appeal it, but you're not going to get anywhere. All right. What can you do? Suppose you know that the mayor of the town, his name is so-and-so. Will knowing the mayor of the town help you at all? So we're in Somerset. The new mayor of Somerset, I think, is Brian Levine, I think is his name. So I happen to know that the mayor of Brian Levine, and the mayor of this town is Brian Levine. If I'm having a problem with taxes, by the way, this ashram pays no real estate tax. Nice. It would be substantial, but as a non-profit religious organization, we're excused from property taxes, so it's really quite a benefit for a religious organization such as ours. But suppose I was a homeowner, and I received this assessment doubled, and I happen to know that the mayor is Brian Levine. How is that knowledge going to help? It's not going to help at all. Just knowing that the mayor is someone who can do something about it, but simply knowing who he is not a solution. If I were his friend, if I were very intimate with him, close, then maybe he could do something about it. But mere knowledge of the solution is not enough. Tena, by that, Raja na paritoshaha, just knowing who the king is not going to be pleased with you and bestow some special favor upon you. That's the metaphor now. Tena, by that, by mere knowledge of who the king happens to be, Raja na paritoshaha, that king is not going to become pleased with you and bestow upon you anything special. So the metaphor then is, here you're trying to reach not the king, you're trying to reach Bhagavan, God. Merely knowing that there is a God of the cosmos is not enough. That's not at his point. Knowing that God is Bhagavan Asti is not enough. So this is why he's refuting the prior statement, Jnanam Eva Sadhanam. So how does he refute it? By saying, knowledge of the king doesn't make your life any easier. And similarly, Tena, by that knowledge, Kshut Na Shantihi Va. We have that na has to be carried over into both parts of the sutra. Kshut is a hunger. Your hunger, kshut, your hunger, Na Shantihi will not be quelled. Shanti means peace, but here with regard to hunger, it means quelled. Satisfied, your hunger will not be quelled, va, or your hunger will not be quelled, tena, by knowledge of food. If you're hungry and you open up a cookbook, is that going to, in fact, that's going to make your hunger worse, if anything. So tena, by that, by knowledge, hunger isn't going to go away. Knowing food doesn't make hunger going away. Knowing that there is a God of the universe doesn't bring you to that God of the universe. This is the argument that Narada employs here to answer the objection, the someone who says, Jnanam eva sadhanam, knowledge alone is the means. Now, a final comment here before we finish this section. Narada has his own perspective. And Narada's perspective is that for most people, the sadhana of bhakti, that is, sadhana of bhakti, not bhakti as a goal, but bhakti as a spiritual practice of prayer, worship, etc., which we'll be talking about. So Narada's whole purpose in writing the scripture is to say that for most people, this is better than knowledge. The emphasis, obviously, this is called Bhakti Sutra, the emphasis is on bhakti. Is it any surprise that if you pick up a text called Bhakti Sutra, the emphasis is bhakti, if you pick up a text called Atma Bodha, the emphasis will be on knowledge. If you pick up Bhagavad Gita, you'll find lots of topics, but you'll find Karma Yoga being perhaps the topic that's most prevalent in that. This is worth recognizing, that in this Hindu tradition, there are many teachers and many texts, all of which have different points of view, different orientations. Does it mean one is right and one is wrong? Certainly not. This is one of the distinguishing characteristics of this tradition, and that is, there's not one and only one way to proceed. So this is a tradition, we discussed that before, this is a tradition that acknowledges our individuality, our differences, and recognizes that what our needs are will vary tremendously from person to person. So here in this text, Narada necessarily puts emphasis on bhakti. Does it mean bhakti is better than jnanam? No. But you can't blame him for putting emphasis on it. What is he teaching? He's teaching bhakti. All right. And he finishes up the section, the 33rd sutra. Tasmat saiva grahya, tasmat saiva grahya, mumukshubihi, mumukshubihi, tasmat. Therefore, sa eva grahya, sa in the strilinga feminine, that sa eva, that alone. What is he referring to? Parabhakti. Sa eva parabhakti. That ultimate bhakti, grahya, is to be gained. Literally grasped, to be gained, to be acquired. Sa eva grahya, that indeed, that alone is to be sought after. But remember, he's talking about parabhakti now. He's not saying you should only go to the temple, you should abandon any kind of scriptural study, jnanam, you should abandon using your work as a form of spiritual practice, karma, you should abandon meditation, dhyana. He's not saying that. He's saying, he didn't say you should abandon anything. He said you should be committed to the goal. The goal is parabhakti. What will it take to reach the goal? Everything. Jnana is required, bhakti is required, dhyana is required, karma is required. Lots of things are required. But he says that the goal, sa parabhakti, that parabhakti is grahya, is to be gained, is to be sought after. By whom? Mumukshubihi. By seekers of moksha. Moksha literally means freedom. And we can take it in the sense of freedom from suffering, or in a context of bhakti, how about freedom from separation? Freedom from being isolated and separate from Bhagavan. So, for mumukshubihi, for those who seek freedom from suffering, who seek freedom from the sense of separation, parabhakti sa eva grahya. That parabhakti, the gaining the condition of utter non-separateness from Bhagavan, is to be sought after. And just to double check, what do you have to... We'll make this like a quiz to see if you followed this. Make it, turn it into a nice trick question. What do you have to do to get the condition of being utterly non-separate from Bhagavan? What do you need to do to gain non-separateness from Bhagavan? And the answer, you all know, is nothing. You already are non-separate from Bhagavan. That's what Tattvamasi and all the other Mahavakyas mean. On the other hand, we're still suffering and struggling, which means not that we have to do anything to be non-separate, but we have to remove that which creates the illusion of separation. Let's hear that one more time. You don't have to get connected to the God of the universe. You are already utterly non-separate. But we suffer and struggle. Why? We feel separate. It's a feeling. Tell me, how reliable are your feelings? How stable are your emotions? They're very fickle. So, that which keeps us separate is a feeling. What do we have to do to reach that goal? Is to remove that sense of separation. That sense of separation is the obstacle. When that obstacle is removed, you discover that you already are that which you want to become. You already possess that which you want to possess. Or in a more bhakti sense, you've already grasped that which you wanted to reach. if we describe this path as trying to reach Bhagavan, so to speak. Already here, already grasped. Okay, this concludes then this section of the Bhakti Sutra. When we meet next time, we'll actually take up a new section, and this is where the more significant dividing line is in the text. Our attention is going to turn away from para bhakti and towards apara bhakti, the lower bhakti, which means we're going to turn away from bhakti as a goal and focus more on bhakti as a spiritual practice. So a lot more to come with that. A couple of important announcements before we wrap up our class.